In the years that followed, leaders such as Spotted Tail of the Cichangu and Red Cloud, an American host of the Oglala, counseled that surviving necessitated learning to live like the whites. Added to the trauma of unwanted change was the insistence of the U.S. government and its missionary allies that we give up our cultural and ethnic identity. Not only were we to live like the whites, we had to assimilate, or to us, become white. So began another kind of war, one for the hearts and minds of the generations to come. Yet in spite of the maelstrom of change we had to contend with, we were still viable as far as our tribal identity was concerned, even though books would be written in the 20th century with titles like The Last Days of the Sioux Nation. If my great-grandparents' generation had succumbed to the relentless intent to kill the Indian and save the man, the battle cry of assimilation voiced by the superintendent of the Carlisle Indian School, the book titles would have been true. There were no more military conflicts between the Lakota and the United States after 1890. But the period from then to the 1940s was no less fraught with turmoil than the last 25 years of the 1800s had been. In 1910, the federal government outlawed the Sundance. Whites were allowed to live within the exterior borders of the reservations. World War I took many young Lakota across the ocean to Europe. Some of them were conscripted into service, but many volunteered. One of them was my grandfather, Charles J. Marshall, who was in the Army Infantry. I heard him remark one time that he had fought as a mercenary for the United States, which was technically true. Indians weren't granted United States citizenship until 1924, without asking us if we wanted it, I should add. Three consequences of white encroachment that all tribes had in common were loss of pre-European lifestyle, loss of land, and loss of culture. The effect was much more devastating on the tribes with smaller populations. The federal government and Christian missionaries knew that the quickest way to destroy a culture is to eliminate its indigenous language. Today, of the nearly 500 tribes still in existence, about 140 retain their native languages. Fortunately, we Lakota are currently one of the 5 indigenous tribes or nations with the highest percentage of native speakers within our population. This in spite of intensive and concerted efforts that were the main thrust of the assimilation process. The Bureau of Indian Affairs and certain churches established boarding schools on the reservations in the early 1900s. Lakota children were placed in the schools and often not allowed to see their parents for the entire school year. There are documented instances where children were not reunited with their parents for several years. Boys with long hair were given haircuts, and everyone was expressly forbidden to speak Lakota. Punishment was swift and often severe for anyone who broke the rule. In the 1930s, my father was made to kneel on a 2x4 for an entire afternoon the first time he was caught speaking Lakota. The second time, he was hung by his thumbs from a basement water pipe and had to stand on tiptoe to avoid dislocating them. A formal education in Christianity, we were told, was our only salvation because the old days were gone. We could no longer chase buffalo, and our spiritual beliefs were heathen and pagan. Much of white society expected us to change our ways and our values like someone taking off one shirt and putting on another. Many of us did embrace Christianity, and since we didn't see any buffalo to chase, we changed with the times, and we began to live like anyone else in this country. In spite of the best efforts of Indian agents, teachers, missionaries, and the generally paternalistic mindset of the American public toward all Indians, we still managed to retain enough of our culture and language to keep our identity intact. Many in my parents' and grandparents' generation don't have a positive opinion about education, which is understandable given the negative experiences they had in church and government boarding schools, where education was a method of taking away their language and culture. To them, anything beyond grammar school or high school was questionable. But in the early 1970s, that instrument of forced change became a way to maintain language and culture. Education has become a positive, strengthening process because of the wisdom and farsightedness of a few people who felt that Indian-controlled colleges on the reservations were the answer. The first such college was established on a Navajo reservation in 1968, and two Lakota reservations in South Dakota followed suit in 1970 and 1971. Oglala Lakota College on a Pine Ridge Reservation and Sinte Galeshka College on a Rosebud Reservation. The primary reason for their establishment is the preservation of language and culture. Sinte Galeshka is Lakota for Spotted Tail, the last traditional leader of the Sichangu, and the institution named for him is now a four-year university with graduate programs. There are many challenges besides education that we Lakota need to face as the 21st century dawns. Alcoholism continues to be a devastating problem. Legal jurisdiction is another. In the mid-1960s, the tribes of South Dakota united to defeat the state's referendum to assume civil and criminal jurisdiction on reservation lands. Loss of land continues to be a challenge and a concern. In 1977, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the state of South Dakota's contention that four of the five counties comprising the Rosebud Sioux Reservation could no longer be considered reservation because more whites owned land in those counties than members of the tribe. Since then, the exterior boundaries of the Rosebud Reservation are the same as for Todd County. Then there is racial prejudice, which in spite of the best efforts from both sides, tends to rear its ugly head occasionally. All in all, we have made significant gains since 1900, but not without some difficulty. In spite of our gains and our losses, we are still Lakota. Lakota language and history is being taught in Indian-controlled schools that were formerly BIA schools, and in a number of public schools as well. To harder the process of assimilation tried to take away our language, our culture, and our identity, the harder we hung on. If the adage mentioned earlier is true, that whatever doesn't kill you will make you stronger, then we are among the sturdiest cultures on the face of the earth. Walking the Circle. Ka'ohomani, the circle, is prominent in Lakota life and is used practically and symbolically because it is part of the reality of the physical environment. Toss a stone into a pond, and waves flow out from the center in growing circles. A falling leaf in autumn often spins in circles before it lands. The sun and moon are circular, and from our perspective, they move in circles. The most powerful force on the plains, the tornado, moves in a circle. Life itself moves in cycles or circles. Our annual calendar is a cycle of 13 months or moons because it is based on the cycles of the moon. There are the four seasons that obviously cycle continuously. And the life cycle for all beings is birth, childhood, adulthood, and old age. A sweat lodge is a simple circular structure that, for me, symbolizes Lakota spiritual beliefs and traditions as well as life itself. The ceremony conducted inside this structure is the Inikarapi, which doesn't mean sweat lodge, nor does it describe any type of structure. It is our word for both the structure and the ceremony. Inikarapi means to make life or to renew life. The English interpretation comes from the fact that participants in a ceremony do literally sweat. The Inikarapi is a round, totally enclosed structure supported by framework. Imagine half a sphere atop the ground measuring roughly 16 feet across and 4 to 5 feet high at its apex. In the old days, the covering was usually buffalo hide. Today, it is generally canvas. Inside, at the very center, is a circular pit to hold heated stones. The door usually opens to the east. A ridge of soil a few inches high is formed in a straight line from the edge of the stone pit and ends at the fire pit outside. Outside, near the fire pit, and in line with it, and with the stone pit inside, is a stone altar. Sage, a pipe, tobacco, and other items necessary for the ceremony are placed on the altar. Perhaps the most practical application of the circle was in the design of dwellings. A circular floor plan goes back a long way, so far, in fact, that no one can remember when the design was first used.